Hello and welcome to ESIB Global Economy Podcast. My name is Oscar Guinea. I am director at ESIB. Our guest today is Lucian Cernat. Lucian is head of unit at DigiTrade in the European Commission and the author of several studies and papers. And today he joined us to talk about his latest paper, Trade Policy 3.0, Three Scenarios for Tomorrowland. You can download and read the paper at the ESIB website. Lucian, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Oscar, and hello, everyone, whoever is listening to us.
Good. Let's start with the questions. In your paper, you describe three generations of trade policy, 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. What defines each phase, and what has really changed from one to the next?
Yes, indeed. I think that's the fundamental question behind the paper, and I would like to try to explain why I think this is a very good framework of analysis to separate the long history of international trade into three distinct periods. In a nutshell, each of them is shaped by a different set of economic realities. In trade policy 1.0, we have the traditional post-war model that was centered on macroeconomic objectives. So I think macroeconomics was the key defining logic behind. And trade policymakers and academics alike were perhaps most interested in the impact of tariff liberalization, classical market access, ways in which we could advance the multilateral rulemaking. So essentially, the core assumption was that reducing border barriers would maximize welfare gains. And frankly, for several decades, for many decades, that logic held. Then we entered trade policy 2.0, essentially at the same time with the rise of global supply chains. Once firms engage in international trade, they started to fragment and slice production across borders, involving many other suppliers and subcontractors. Then this economic reality combined also with a fairly important fundamental change in the economic thinking underpinning trade policy analysis, this importance of individual firms, led to what I called in 2014 a new trade policy 2.0 period. So in this period, we moved away, I think, in our key questions from classical trade questions. We started to look at regulatory frictions, standards, investment, all the kinds of things that individual companies worry about in the behind the border. The type of measures, technical barriers to trade. So I think if I were to summarize trade policy 2.0 in some simple terms, first is the change from macroeconomics to microeconomic to firm level realities. My preferred motto of the trade policy 2.0 period is countries don't trade, firms do. And I recently authored a paper where I apply this idea to the EU-Canada FTA, the CETA agreement, looking with co-authors at the one of the critical elements in trade policy 2.0, which is supply chain, as I said, but also SME, small and medium firms' participation in global supply chains. And that in itself changed in many ways the way in which we did trade policy making during these recent decades. And now what the paper is arguing is that now we're entering into a new era, which I call trade policy 3.0. And in this new era, at least to me, the current environment is shaped by systemic shocks and geopolitical tensions, among many other things. So again, one very distinct difference between trade policy 3.0 and previous eras is that efficiency is no longer the sole organizing principle. We have now key objectives and key parameters revolving around issues like resilience, strategic autonomy, economic security. These are now core policy objectives in trade policy. So in other words, what we had as an evolution for decades since the World War II in Trade Policy 1.0, which evolved then in Trade Policy 2.0 with a certain continuity. Now we are faced with a significant disruptive set of issues that would, if they succeed in the tendencies we see now, that will lead to a very, very different Trade Policy 3.0.
When I was reading your paper, kind of a thought I had was that kind of this trade policy 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0, it kind of tells the story of different generations, right? So in a way, trade policy 1.0 is the baby boomers generation X type of trade policy. Mm-hmm. Trade policy 2.0 is more like, well, it could be a mix of people having born in Generation X or millennials like myself. And the kind of trade policy that those who are coming to terms now with Generation Z will be trade policy 3.0. So my question to you is, how does the time when you started to work on international trade really shape the way you think about trade policy?
I think that's an excellent question and a very useful analogy, Oscar. I actually haven't thought about it when I created this conceptual framework to analyze trade policy, but it's very fitting indeed. So if we go with that analogy, I think I can clearly say that I belong to Gen X and I entered trade policy this last phase of trade policy 1.0, I joined trade policy when I was a young trade diplomat in the Romanian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, doing some bilateral negotiations at the time. And then I moved to Geneva, where I was part of the UN in charge of trade and development. So yes, I was shaped in a way by this golden age of trade policy 1.0, where principles mattered, this idea that we trust on trade liberalization to deliver its benefits to countries around the world, and in my capacity at the time also to maximize the development dividends of openness. That was the dominant and the defining logic that shaped my thinking. It allowed me also to very quickly move into trade policy 2.0, which, as I said, was a natural evolution without changing too much in terms of principles. I was rather enthusiastically jumping into trade policy 2.0, looking at firm level competitiveness, global supply chain issues. And I think that was really important. Now, the same for those other generations. If you are a millennial, probably you joined trade policy in the 2.0 period, and then you were probably really immediately dragged into how to make sure that we are efficiently working together. It's about standards, logistics, investments, digital flows already was a big thing. And I think the question wasn't anymore, shouldn't we integrate in trade policy 2.0? The question was, how do we make sure that we integrate in the most efficient manner? Now, if you are a Gen Z, I think you would then enter now in trade policy, the end of trade policy 2.0, the beginning of trade policy 3.0, and your thinking will be shaped by a different landscape. It's, as I said, geopolitical shocks, avoiding overdependencies. There's a revival industry policy going on right now. There is a very important blend now between securitization and economics. There's no longer just the core economic principles. There's a lot of geopolitics involved. So you will develop instincts to interrogate yourselves about how to avoid vulnerability, how to avoid the risk of over-concentration of supply chains, how do we build resilience. So I think you're right. In a way, the period when you start working in trade policy may in fact have lasting consequences on your way of thinking.
Absolutely. It's like when people say that the music that you listen when you are in adolescence really marks your taste for music forever, right? It really stays with you. I remember when I started to work in trade policy, I mean, it was with you at the Chief Economist. I was an intern. That was my first job in international trade. And at this time, we were moving. It was in the 2010, so I think it placed me in trade policy 2.0. And we were moving from multilateral trade policy, the Doha round, to doing bilateral SFTAs. And the trade agenda started to get opened as a response to the Seattle Ministerial Conference. So there was more topics about human rights, the environment. But there was a clear expectation that there was only one way that tariffs will go, and that was down. So the feeling of trade as a force for good and the importance of integrating countries within global value chains for development was very, very present.
So, yes, you're right. I mean, I'm going to be a bit provocative now, but for those colleagues who dealt with tariffs in that period for many years, I personally thought that in trade policy 2.0, when we had so many other important questions on the table, frankly, those days, if you were dealing with tariffs, I personally thought that was such a dull topic, like this is boring tariffs. I mean, this is so behind us, which is no longer the case nowadays. So indeed, at the time, if in at the peak of trade policy 2.0, if you wanted to be advancing the policy agenda or the policy research agenda, you would be looking at, as I said, from level data, trade ands, lots of trade ands, all sorts of things. You would probably try to collect detailed statistics. We've been looking at the participation of small and medium enterprises, how they become unicorns and competitive, even, you know, being born global. All these things were probably the exciting part of trade policy 2.0. But now, in a way, we're back to tariffs.
Yeah, and remind us, what is your current title in the European Commission, right? You have ride the waves of trade policy 1.0, 2, and 3, and now you are dealing with tariffs in DG Trade, correct?
I am in charge of tariffs, but as I said, now is not a dull moment. I think dealing with tariffs now, it's extremely important, and we have many challenges ahead. But speaking of our own DG, the name of the DG has changed, so we are DG Trade and Economic Security. So that's also a sign of the times we live in.
Indeed, the clue is in the name. So something that really separates trade policy 3.0 from the earlier phases is the role of international organizations. You describe that in your paper. So from your point of view, how important is the WTO, the World Trade Organization, in the era of trade policy 3.0?
Yes, this is a difficult question in a sense. I don't think I have a definitive answer in my paper to it, but here I can probably try to speculate a bit more. In reality, if you think about it, in trade policy 3.0, the role of the WTO becomes a bit paradoxical. On the one hand, it's more essential than ever. If you look at the challenges we face, we would need WTO now more than before. That's one part of the paradox. The other part of the paradox is that when you look at the WTO and its current positioning on all these strategically important topics, we realize that somehow it seems structurally less capable of delivering what policymakers expect in this new environment. So why is that so? I think in my personal opinion, I think that the core mandate of the WTO, transparency, predictability, rules-based disciplines, that's exactly what we need now in an era defined by uncertainty, geopolitical friction. And so when some countries try to weaponize interdependence, if you have a strong set of multilateral rules and if you have a very strong institution, that's not a luxury. This is a very powerful stabilizing factor if we could reach that stage. So in that sense, the WTO could be a foundational element in a new trade policy 3.0. It could reinvent itself. But here's the other side of the paradox. Because trade policy 3.0 is driven by issues where that the WTO was not originally designed to handle, it faces difficulties to enter in these new topics now. I mean, economic security, data governance, technology controls, outbound or inbound investment screenings, critical raw materials, and the list could go on and on. These are topics that would probably fall into gray zones in any WTO agreement. We have plenty WTO agreements. They are supposed to be coherent with each other, but if you were to place all these topics squarely in one or the other WTO committees, it would be very difficult. So I think the challenge of the WTO's traditional legal boundaries and the consensus-based decision-making will make its new role in this very polarizing type of topics much more difficult. So now we end up with an institution that remains normatively very important, but at least for the time being, increasingly mismatched with the core policy agenda. So I think the upcoming WTO ministerial next year would offer a very good opportunity in this regard to see if the WTO reform could bring a new impetus in this domain. So just need to be patient and let's see what happens.
Very good. So let's see what happened. So let's continue unwrapping this concept of trade policy 3.0. So you point out that COVID-19 was a major driver. And I remember during that period, you co-authored a great paper, a DigiTrade paper, showing the benefits of imports and open supply chains. It's a paper that I have read several times and recommend to everyone listening to read it. So my question to you is, why do you think the lessons many governments drew was to make trade harder, not easier, when you showed exactly the opposite?
That's I think a question that will we can go on and on these elements because there are so many things to unpack, but I could start with some very simple answers and then I will expand. So first thing is that during crisis, I think time gets compressed. People need to react very fast. So we have this famous book by a Nobel Prize winner about think slow and think fast. So in a crisis, you don't have the luxury to think slow. And think slow is the rational, you know, you have time to reflect, you have time to look at all the consequences. In a crisis, you have to think fast. Sometimes when you think fast, you have to, respond to instincts and things that you prioritize. And there is also the fear factor. And in a crisis, fear travels faster than the data. So even though we had all this data and the two of us wrote a nice blog for eSci, I remember still the title with references to ants and dinosaurs and the resilience and how you can, what's the best way to survive through a trade apocalypse. All these elements had only limited impact on policymakers, because at the same time, policymakers, they probably saw empty shelves in some critical goods for a while. They saw that some countries introduced export bans, or they had some knee-jerk reaction to some other measures. So in the end, what prevailed was the narrative of we need to avoid overdependence, we need to fight vulnerability. And these were powerful narratives, emotionally intuitive and politically mobilizing. So in the end, data had only a limited impact to shape that debate. So we saw that the reaction was suboptimal, maybe a bit too late. And in parallel, COVID also coincided with a broader geopolitical shift. It was the pandemic, but there were many other things that made a few trading partners look at each other as strategic rivals. So when you put all these things together, you realize that people pay a lot of attention to those elements that I mentioned in the paper: resilience, strategic autonomy. Therefore, I think the data pointed one way, but the politics pointed another way. And the bottom line is very simple. Now we can say very clearly, and everyone would agree, that COVID-19 didn't prove that globalization failed. Now it's clear. Now we have the time to think slowly. We have all the data, and we're no longer under crisis, so we can see the evidence. But at the same time, we have new forces that will, in my view, shape trade policy 3.0 in a way that will take these new priorities into account in an important way. So this security, the politics, and the resilience will have an important element in the future.
This takes us very nicely to the next question, because in your paper, you don't only talk about the past, but you venture into the future, and you outline three possible futures: immunity, sclerosis, and contagions. Can you unpack this for us?
Well, first, I probably need a caveat. If a Nobel Prize in physics had to put a caveat saying that prediction is very, very difficult, especially when it's about the future, I should probably say the same. I think economics is far more uncertain than physics. So that caveat applies even more to economics or trade policy. So yes, prediction about possible futures is extremely fraught with uncertainty. So I'm not sure I have any better educated guess than any of our listeners here. But I thought that logically speaking, we see the potential for three distinct scenarios to unfold. So one I called immunity, the other one I call sclerosis, and the last one, the worst case scenario in a way, is contagion. The immunity is the easy one, is the optimistic scenario. It means that all the things we like about this standard trade policy 1.0 or 2.0, they will remain dominant as an organizing principle, as the logic of international trade. But in this framework, new elements will be adapted and they will fit nicely together. So it's like, imagine that the, in a way, trade policy 2.0 gets a vaccine, gets some antibodies, and that it is immune to trade policy 3.0, but at the same time, it adjusts a bit to these new realities. Sclerosis is the middle scenario where the system doesn't collapse, but it doesn't reform either. And everyone knows that something needs to be done, but nobody gets to agree on what and how exactly we should do things. So we will continue to trade. We will have probably more sluggish trade, less predictable, but we will not have a real crisis. That's why it's more like stagnation. So the system will be a bit more hard, harder to navigate, but it's more of the same, I would say, what we currently see at the moment. Now, contagion is the pessimistic scenario where things can go a lot worse than today, when we have a lot of even more politicized trade relations. The trust will break down across multiple supply chains. There will be systemic fragmentation, and then we'll even have competing blocks trying to preserve all these new priorities of resilience, strategic autonomy, etc. So the global economy will no longer be, in fact, paradoxically resilient. By trying to become resilient, if we have too much fragmentation, we lose resilience. So I hope contagion doesn't go that far. So this is it. In three simple terms, immunity would be like adaptation, sclerosis is stagnation, and contagion is fragmentation.
Okay, so my last question before we end the podcast. If I give you 100 euros to bet on which scenario will define the next decade, how will you split that bet across the three scenarios?
100 euros, that's very generous of you. Let's see what we can make out of 100 euros. Let's maximize our returns on this together, right? Now, if you trust me with 100 euros, Oscar, one thing I promise you is that I would not spend it all in one place. So I would definitely spread it on all three scenarios, because I think the world is far too complicated for a single trajectory. Frankly, I don't know which one is going to happen. They're all perfectly plausible in my view. And if the idea were to put the 100 euros in a way that we maximize our returns, I think we also need to take into account what others are thinking. So I ran a little poll on LinkedIn, and I think most places, most people place their bets on sclerosis and contagion. So if you want to have high returns, we should also put a little bit of our 100 euros on immunity, because if that scenario turns out to be true, we get all the money. Everyone else is betting on sclerosis or contagion. If we're the only ones betting on immunity, then that means we win big. But that scenario probably means it's not as likely as the others. So here's my proposal. Let's spread it evenly across all three scenarios and see what happens in a couple of years from now.
But the diplomats spread evenly and the economists spreading the bet. Very good. Lucian, thank you so much for this conversation and for helping us navigate what's next in global trade. And for everyone listening, you can find Lucian's excellent paper and many of his other papers, which I also recommend, in the ESIP website. Have a nice day.
Thank you, Oscar.